and Commerce Committee. It's 12:35, Saturday, April 11th, 2015. With me this afternoon is Vice Chair Giesel, Senator Giesel, and Senator Stevens. And on today's agenda, we have, I also want to thank the Recording Secretary, Carrie, and also the LIO operator, Jessica. Thank you for your help. Without you, we couldn't have this hearing today on a weekend. I really appreciate that. And also my committee aide, Weston Eiler. Today, we have four items on the agenda. We have House Bill 149 by Representative Pruitt, Senate Bill 58 by the Senate State Affairs Committee, which is known as the Transportation Services Network. Senate Bill 107, which was read across on the floor today, that is an insurance-related bill by the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. And then we will round it out with Senate Bill 99 by Senator Machicki. And so with that, I want to welcome Representative Pruitt's staff, Dirk Kraft, and ask the members if you have any questions for the sponsor's staff. This is on House Bill 149. An amendment of the Articles of Incorporation of certain Native corporations to establish a lower quorum requirement for shareholder meetings. Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to make sure I understand this, I think I understand the issue of changing the quorum. Does this change any other requirements for voting? Does it lower the bar for any other voting, any other issues that go on?
For the record, Dirk Kraft, staff to Representative Pruitt, through the chair, Senator Stevens, no, we kept the focus of the bill very narrow, so they can only amend their articles of incorporation for that one-time quorum change.
All right. Thank you.
Any further questions? With that, so we have opened and closed public testimony on this bill, and so Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I move House Bill 149, version 29, LS0534/alpha.alpha from this committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note.
Is there any objection? Great. Seeing that no objection, this bill is moved from committee. And thank you for coming this morning. Appreciate it. Next for the committee is Senate Bill 58, the Transportation Network Services and Workers' Compensation. I'd like to welcome the Senator Stoltz's aide. This is the second hearing. It's our intention to adopt the committee substitute, take members' questions and public testimony, and look to the will of the committee. And I'm going to take a brief Eddie so I can sign the previous document. Committee is called back to order. As I mentioned, our intent is to adopt the committee substitute. So, Senator Giesel.
Madam Chair, I move the committee adopt the working draft for Senate Bill number 58, version 29 LS0616/November as the working document.
Thank you. And I will object for the purpose of discussion and give you a chance to go over the changes.
All right. For the record, my name is Brandon Brzezinski, staff to Senator Stoltz. The bill that you have before you today is quite different from what we started with. We've added several new provisions to clarify the problems that we had with the insurance. And initially, we had issue with where the insurance provisions were placed. So then you'll find that there are insurance provisions within Title 21 and Title 28 for DMV. So if you'd like, I can walk through a sectional here and explain these.
Please do.
Okay. So Section 1, it provides clarification for insurers regarding personal insurance policies and transportation network company insurance policies. Section 2 is providing new definitions, and you'll notice there are a lot, there are several new definitions.
Do you mind also telling the members what page you're on when you move from one section to the next?
Yes, no problem. So, let's see. Section 2 starts on page 3, line 3, and that's where you'll find new definitions for digital network, personal vehicle, prearranged ride, transportation network company driver, and transportation network company rider. Section 3 of the bill is on page 4, line 8, and this is the workers' comp exemption, and we are exempting transportation network company drivers and horse carriage operators from the Workers' Compensation Act. That's at the request of the chairman of the State Affairs Committee. Section 4 is providing the same definitions that were in Section 2. Section 4 is on page 5, starting line 12.
And I'd like to welcome Senate President Kevin Meyer.
Okay, Section 5 is on page 6, line 16. And we are amending Title 28 by adding a new chapter. And this is Chapter 23, Transportation Network Companies and Drivers. And the first new provision is financial responsibility of transportation network companies. And this is basically outlining what are the insurance requirements for transportation network companies. So it's provides insurance requirements for TNCs and clarifies coverage between personal insurance and transportation network company insurance. The next provision is which you'll find on page 8, starting at line 11, 2823015, transportation network company automobile insurance disclosures. This is requiring the disclosure of insurance coverage to a driver. The transportation network company has to disclose the insurance coverage to the driver of the TNC, and that they also need to disclose that the driver's personal insurance policy may not cover them in the event of an accident. Section 6 starts on page 9, line 29. This is the applicability clause for sections 3 and 4. Section 7 on page 10 is the retroactivity clause for sections 3, 4, and 6. Section 8, again, these are all on page 10 here. Section 8 is the effective date for section 5, and section 9 is the immediate effective date except for section 8. So with that, if there's any questions, I believe we have somebody from a transportation network company online from Uber, and I believe there's somebody from insurance, PCI, that is online as well.
Is there further objection to adopting the committee substitute? Seeing none, I will remove my objection, and now we have the committee substitute as a working document before the committee. Do members have any questions for the sponsor or the department? Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to maybe remind them, how does it work when you to move from the personal insurance to the company insurance? How does that practically work? It's just simply a matter of notifying the insurance company? How does that happen?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, I believe we have someone online from Uber who could explain that, but I could take a crack at it if you'd like.
If you can.
Yes. So, like, when you are logged on to the app, the digital network, that is when there's two phases of insurance. So when you're driving your own vehicle, you're not logged on to the app, you're under your own personal insurance. As soon as you've turned the app on, seeking passengers, you're covered then under the provisions, and they're on page, would be section 5. starting on page 6, actually. So when you log on to the app, you'll be covered under a $50,000 death and bodily injury policy, $100,000 for death and bodily injury for each incident, and $25,000 property damage policy. As soon as you've, then if somebody wants a ride, as soon as you've accepted that ride, you are now covered under a $1 million insurance policy, and these are all provided through the transportation network company. As soon as you drop that person off, and say you're still logged onto the app, you revert back to that smaller $25,000, $50,000, $100,000 policy, or if you turn the app off, you are now back on your own personal insurance.
Thank you. That helps understand that. So are you as a driver still covered under your personal insurance at all, or is that no longer in effect once you go on to the company insurance?
In Section 1 of the bill, insurers are not required to cover you under your own personal insurance if you are logged onto the app or covered through a transportation network company's policy. So it's up to the insurers.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Brandon, so what assurances do we have that drivers won't just log on and because they know they're covered? And is there a provision? Is it just the specific state law that would require them to have personal insurance, just like, you know, that we are required to?
Madam Chair, if the state law would require you to have personal insurance if you're trying to drive your own personal vehicle. And companies like Uber, and I don't want to speak for Uber, but they require you, there's several requirements in order for you to become a driver for Uber. Like, you have to have insurance, your vehicle has to go through an inspection and be, you know, checked for safety. So you're not going to be working for a TNC without having personal insurance of your own. So, but I could let Uber speak to that further if you'd like.
And then what about the protection that there won't be abuse, so that you won't turn it on, so that you know, because you'll be covered under a different policy? I mean, was there any discussion as to how that would be addressed?
Madam Chair, so if you're saying, like, if I'm driving my vehicle, I turn it on, but if I'm driving my vehicle and I have my own insurance policy, or I should under law, if I don't, the likelihood of you working for a TNC you probably wouldn't be working for a TNC. But in terms of abuse, like, if I was sitting at home and I turned the app on, and then somebody was driving, and somebody else got in my car and drove down the road, would that vehicle then be covered by the policy of the TNC? Is that what you're getting at?
No, I'm asking that you're in your vehicle and you've turned your app on, and it's you're covered under, you know, the transportation services required insurance. How do we know that that isn't turned on in cases where there is no client at the end, so that it's turned on and they're covered under an insurance policy that really is not the one that they should be covered under? They should be covered under their personal.
Madam Chair, well, if you turn, I can let Uber speak to that. I'm going to defer to the transportation network.
Okay, well, I have them down under public testimony, so I'm sure they're listening to the questions, and we'll keep track of those and answer those when it comes to them. And then could you discuss the horse carriage provision? Was this a problem that we're fixing? Just give us, the members, a little bit of background on that, please.
Sure. Madam Chair, Senator Stoltz, Chairman of the State Affairs Committee, which this bill is sponsored from, has constituents within his district who operate horse carriage services, and he figured if we're exempting other forms of transportation, why not do horse carriages as well? It falls under the same type of line of work.
Okay. Any further questions from committee members? So we have online Mike, Mike Monagle, the director from the Labor and Workers' Compensation, and we also have Lori Winghire with the Division of Insurance. Do members have any questions for either of those individuals? No. Okay. Thank you. Okay. We also have the Assistant Attorney General, Kimberly Rogers, and the Division of Motor Vehicles Director, Nicole Tom, online for questions. Members have any questions for those individuals? Okay. So then I will continue with public testimony. Is there anyone here in Juneau that would like to testify on this legislation? Seeing none, I will go to Armand Feliciano from California with the Property Casualty Insurers.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. Armand Feliciano with Property Casualty Insurers Association of America. For National Trade, we represent Property Casualty Insurance in Alaska, like Dyck and Progressive. Testifying today to express our support for SB 58. It is a national compromise language, what you see now in Sections 1 and 5, to address the insurance gaps that we previously had concerns about. So in our view, at this point, as amended, this bill will be good for the driver, passenger, and the public, as laws regarding insurance will be clear should an accident happen. Also, if you're familiar with the bill, is pretty flexible. We're trying to accommodate innovation for TNCs as well as for insurance companies to develop products around these types of vehicles. It also provides adequate disclosure to drivers so they know exactly what the limitations are or what coverages are. Let me just close this real quick. We believe, as drafted now, it does protect liability insurance, address that issue, and is a good public policy bill as it provides insurance protection whenever an Uber driver operates in Alaska. I heard the questions raised by the committee members on a couple of things. So if I can walk you real quick, functionally how this would work. Think of this as two periods. One of the concerns we had initially is when someone is logged on without a passenger, which insurance is responsible? And this bill would make it clear that it could be the personal insurance depending on that product if they have an endorsement. It could be provided by the TNCs themselves if they choose to do that. Or it could be a hybrid product where it's a cross between a commercial or a personal policy. So that in itself, we feel strongly that it's going to be settled with this bill to correct that issue on period one, which is the app is on, but nobody's there. On period two, once the passenger gets in there, you will see that the Uber policy or the driver again at a much higher limit. I think it's about $1 million limit, recognizing the fact that you now have a passenger and, obviously the risk is a little higher at that point. So I don't know if that answers your question, but I'm prepared to answer any more questions if you have an insurance. Thank you.
Any questions from committee members?
I do have a question. So is there a way then that the driver will indicate that they have a passenger on the app? That the passenger is actually in the vehicle?
This works is that once the driver accepts in the app the actual passenger, at that point there's a record now electronically that the driver has accepted the passenger, and it's on the way to pick up that passenger.
So you had testified earlier that once the passenger's in the car, but what you actually mean is once the driver has accepted the passenger and is on the way to get them.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification. Okay. Thank you very much. Next, we have Carla Jacobs calling in from Chicago with Uber Technologies. Carla?
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Carla Jacobs. I work on the policy team for Uber Technologies. Thank you for your time today, and I apologize I'm not able to be there physically for the meeting. A couple of weeks ago, my colleague Bryce Bennett had the opportunity to outline specifically how this bill will clear up the relationship between NCs and the small businesses they partner with. Since those committee meetings, we've worked with multiple industry parties, including members of the insurance industry, who you just heard from, to address the concerns that were raised a few weeks ago with regard to insurance. As Armand mentioned the language before, he was part of a national agreement that multiple states have now adopted for transportation network company insurance. As a result, this bill now provides regulatory clarity on the requirements for transportation network company insurance, and defining TNC-affiliated drivers as independent contractors. I'll just take a minute and briefly revisit what Uber is and how our onboarding and operations work, and then I'm happy to take any questions. So as you know, Uber is a technology platform, and what we do is connect riders in search of a safe, reliable ride with the nearest driver through a cashless transaction. The system brings unprecedented levels of accountability to transportation in cities, where you know exactly who your driver is, where they are, and you're able to leave feedback after every trip. How our onboarding process works is that drivers can apply through an online platform. They submit documentation, including their driver's license, their vehicle registration and insurance, their inspection form. They then go through a stringent background check conducted by an accredited third party. This includes county, federal, and multi-state records. We do a check of their vehicle records, the criminal background check, and the National Criminal Sex Offender Database. Each driver then also gets a 19-point vehicle inspection at a local certified mechanic. And only after taking and completing all of those steps can a driver partner with the Uber platform. Once a driver is an active partner, he or she is the one that owns the vehicle and operates the vehicle. Uber does not own or operate any vehicles. That driver has the complete freedom and flexibility to log on to the platform anytime, day or night. We do not operate under a shift. We don't operate shifts. Partners can determine their own hours, and on average, partners will use the platform about 5 hours a week or just 20 hours a month. A partner can take one trip a week or 25 trips a week. It's completely up to them. How the platform works, it's not a dispatch service. A driver would receive a request directly from the rider and can then choose whether to accept it or not. Each partner is his or her own small business. In some cities where we operate, those partners are actually required to get their own individual business licenses. Partners take home 80% of every fare, and there's no hourly rate. They get 80% of the fare, and then the 20% is provided to Uber for a licensing fee to use the application. At the end of each year, drivers receive a 1099 form. There's no tax withholding. And in cities where multiple transportation network companies operate, for example, Lyft or Sidecar, the partner drivers have the freedom to partner with multiple platforms, and they can partner with Lyft and Sidecar and choose when to accept rides from the different platforms. So given that information, I'm happy to answer any questions or provide any additional information that would be helpful at this time.
Senator Stevens.
Well, thank you. I appreciate your comments and what a fascinating business this is, and really taking advantage of modern technology. I don't know if you're the right person to ask this, but can you tell us the impact you've had on independent taxi cab companies in the various cities you operate in? I ask that because having been on a city council years ago, we authorized taxi cab companies, and they sort of buy their permits. So, are you finding that this is impacting that business pretty heavily, or can you tell me?
So it varies depending on the situation in every city, but in many cities, we've seen actually a positive impact on taxi companies as well as taxi drivers. In some cities, taxi drivers have chosen to work for a taxi company and, in addition, partner with Uber as a way to supplement their income, just like anyone else in any other profession. They would use Uber as a way to supplement their income. In addition, we've seen in cities such as Milwaukee, where there was a limit on the number of taxi cab permits available to the city. We worked with the city there, and the city changed the permitting structure to allow for increases to accommodate transportation network companies as well as additional taxi cab permits. So both of those examples are ways that we've positively impacted the number of taxi companies as well as the opportunities for taxi drivers in cities.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, if I may, you said there's an 80-20 split, and that 20% of the fare goes to Uber for the use of the app. Is there what else do you provide your drivers? Do you also provide insurance, correct?
Yeah. So like was mentioned in the previous testimony, the insurance can be provided by an individual driver, it can be provided by a transportation network company, or it can be provided by a combination of the two. So Uber provides insurance for drivers, but they could also buy that on their own, and they could operate under their own insurance policy.
Okay, great. So I guess what I'm still a little unclear of, and I was late, I might have missed this. If I'm an Uber driver and I have my app on and I'm watching TV, am I considered covered under your insurance, for example, if that's the insurance I choose, or if I'm going to the grocery store and I have my app on and I get in an accident, even though I don't have a passenger, am I covered under your insurance, or is that my personal, or how does that work?
Well, it would depend for each driver. If a driver had an insurance policy that allowed for coverage during period one, which is the time period that you're talking about when the application is on but there's no ride yet accepted, if an individual had a policy with a rider that covered that time, then it would be that driver's policy. If not, then it would be Uber's policy.
Okay, so if I may, Madam Chair, I'm just trying to get this in my head, which is hard today. My app is on, and I have not accepted a fare or a passenger. Then, as far as you're concerned, that driver's not covered under your insurance. It's not until they actually accept the.
No, so let's say for the purposes of just this example, if you had gone through the requirements to be an Uber driver partner and you had your own insurance as it is today, if your insurance did not have a clause that would cover that period one, then Uber's coverage would apply in that scenario. If you were, if you purchased a policy that had that coverage or had a rider on your individual coverage that you have right now, then your coverage would apply.
Okay. I think I understand. Thank you. I think I got it. Thank you.
Okay.
Is there anyone else online who would wish to testify on this bill? Okay, seeing none, public testimony is closed. Are there any further questions of the sponsor of the committee members? Seeing none, Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move the Senate Bill number 58, version 29, LS0616/November, from committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note.
Is there any objection? Seeing none, the bill is moved from committee. We'll take a brief eddies to sign the documents. Senate Labor and Commerce Committee is called back to order. Now we will have Senate Bill 107. It's related to insurance. This is the first hearing on the bill that was just read across the floor today. The intent is to hear a presentation from the department, take members' questions, take public testimony, and then set the bill aside for further consideration. And I'd like to introduce my committee aide, Weston Eiler, who will be introducing the bill. And then following that, we will take a brief at ease while we bring up the Division of Insurance Director Lori Winghire and Chip Wagner with the Division of Insurance, the Regulation Specialist, for questions. So with that, welcome, Weston.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Weston Eiler, staff to Senator Costello and the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. Senate Bill 107, is a committee bill that deals with many aspects of insurance, specifically the Division of Insurance Financial Section. It also relates to the accreditation of the division and several pieces of model legislation that help the division and the department deal with interstate commerce and a variety of different regulations and standards that are applied to insurers inside Alaska and examinations of outside insurers as well. There's a myriad of issues that are dealt with in this bill, Madam Chair. The title is quite extensive and deals with everything from risk management, holding companies, examinations, and a variety of other roles that the division director has. With your permission, Madam Chair, I'll actually turn the presentation over to Director Lori Winghier, the division director for Division of Insurance. She'll give us a overview and kind of frame the issue that is dealt with in this bill, specifically the accreditation of the division by the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. She'll then also walk through a fairly hearty sectional analysis that will give members a good analysis of what is dealt with in the bill piece by piece and how this relates to both conforming standards among states and also federal requirements that are being handed down through the federal regulatory bill known as Dodd-Frank and some other national legislation as well.
Great. Thank you, Weston. Madam, we'll take a brief at ease. Senate Labor and Commerce Committee is called back to order. I'd like to welcome Lori Winghier and Chip Wagner.
Thank you. Again, my name is Lori Winghier for the record, and I'm the Director of the Division of Insurance. Before you, you have a brief PowerPoint, which hopefully is briefer than the title of the bill. And I will go through it, and please ask any questions. Starting with slide two, the issue with the bill goes back to the mission of the Division of Insurance, which is to regulate the insurance industry to protect Alaska consumers. And as we go through the bill, you will see that the intent of the bill is no more than, as long as the title may be and as long as the bill may be, the intent is to ensure that the solvency of the insurance company is doing business in the state of Alaska is whole. I know that the bill is long, I know that the sectional analysis is long, and the title is long, but it has to do with the accreditation. There is nothing more in this bill but the accreditation of the domestic insurance companies and the insurers doing business in the state of Alaska, and again, to protect the consumers. Unlike any other major industry in state government, the business of insurance is governed or regulated by the Division of Insurance in the individual states. In 1945, Congress passed the McCarran-Ferguson Act, which put the business or the transaction of insurance under the states, taking it away from federal regulation. That holds today, state-based regulation. It holds because it works. Even though we may see differences among states, demographics, regions, and risks within the individual states that others do not have, state-based regulation holds. Even in 2010, under Dodd-Frank, when they set up the Federal Insurance Office, which has the duty to monitor state-based regulation, we still have our state-based. One of the important fundamentals of state-based regulation is accreditation, which is looking for reciprocity in having the solvency of the insurance companies amongst insurance companies that are domiciled here and doing business outside Alaska, or insurance companies that are domiciled outside in doing business here, that when they come in to do business here, we know that they are being judged by the same solvency standards that we judge our own. And as we go through this bill, you will see that for all the words and all the titles, that's what we're looking at. That's what we're trying to pass in this model legislation, is to see that there's reciprocity amongst the statutes, not just between Alaska or in Alaska and what we're asking our insurers to meet, but what the insurers in the other 56 or the other 55 jurisdictions, the states and the territories, and the District of Columbia are being asked to meet. State-based regulation was challenged again in the 2007-2009 financial crisis, and the GAO, in a report to Congress, again supported remaining at state-based regulation. And I don't want to harp too much on it, but when we look at federal, the FIO, all of us that sit as a director level or the commissioner level.
Excuse me, do you mind, where possible, explaining the acronyms just for those who might be listening?
Sure. The Federal Insurance Office, which sits under Treasury, U.S. Treasury. And it was set up in 2010, again, and under the U.S. Treasury Department. It is to monitor the insurance industry, to monitor state-based regulation. And while it does monitor, it is poised to step in if we ever fail as state-based regulators. And as a state-based regulator, along with my counterparts in the other jurisdictions, I don't want to say that we fight it every day, but we are constantly reminded of it, because none of us want to cede to federal regulation, to give up the state-based regulation. One, it works, and two, we don't want to give up state-based when it works well for the individual states to something that may not work, an overall act that may not work individually. What works for one may not work for all.
And I'd like to welcome Senator Ellis.
Thank you.
Senator Ellis, we are on Senate Bill 107, which, if you didn't miss this morning, was the one with the long title.
Yes.
So
thank you.
We are going through the sectional.
Madam Chair.
Senator Stevens?
I know this is probably pretty fundamental, but so part of your job is to make sure that claims are paid. You follow up on that. You follow through on that. You monitor that. Is that true?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, yes, we do. Insurance companies, through their reporting, as we will hit on briefly here, they do show us what they are expecting to pay, what they have paid in their financials.
Thank you.
Slide 5. The National Association of Insurance Commissioners. This is a organization that is the U.S. standard setting in the U.S. for insurance regulation. We belong, as do the other jurisdictions, and it's through the NAIC that model laws are developed. They are created for... They start as in working groups, task force. The model laws come up. It takes 4 years to make a model law. They then come home to the legislators, such as yourselves, to decide if they are the best for the state to be adopted and put forward. The only time a state is required to adopt a model law is for an accreditation, and again, it's for the reciprocity, so that we know again that the domestic insurers coming up here to do business are being judged as we would judge our own.
Lori, when was the last time the state went through this process of reaccreditation?
Madam Chairman, we were accredited in 2012. And we are coming up for accreditation in 2017. We have a report due as to our accreditation status on the adoption of model laws and where we're at in June of this year. On slide 6, we talk about the committees and the task force a little bit more. Alaska sits on two of the letter committees, which are the property and casualty, the market regulation, and consumer affairs. We sit on 14 task force, 3 liaison committees, numerous working groups, and I vice chair the American Indian and the Alaska Native Liaison Committee. And it's in these committees where the discussions come forward of what's best for regulation. So this isn't when these laws are brought forward. It's not a simple process. They have been well vetted by all jurisdictions. These are well thought out, and it's not just the regulators. These are brought out for the industry comment and for public comment. So again, these have been vetted and agreed to generally by all jurisdictions and stakeholders that will be subject to these laws.
And I have a question for you. So you or the division staff attend all of these meetings, and I'm just curious how much of your time is dedicated to efforts related to the NAIC?
Madam Chair, we do attend a fair number of meetings. There's three, not quarterly, but there's three meetings a year that we try to attend. I can't say we attend them all, but we try. And we have a lot of conference committee calls. And then I will on occasion send staff if there is a subject, a new subject coming up, that I will send staff back to the Kansas City office to attend.
And how many other states have gone through this process that we're in right now?
All the states are accredited right now.
You mean, so we're behind then?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Stevens?
No.
Oh, okay.
I am on slide 7 right now. And this is just hitting home on what the accreditation program is to establish and maintain state regulator standards to promote sound insurance company financial solvency regulation. And it's a critical function getting back again to consumer protection. Slide 8. We believe it's important for two to watch the domestics that are coming in here. We have about 1,100 insurance companies doing business in the state of Alaska. Through the accreditation program, I can look at their solvency. I can look at their financial records because my counterparts in the other jurisdictions are doing the examinations, the financial examinations, and looking at the records in the same way I would or ask my financial examiners to. The insurance companies that are domiciled here, we're examining them. And when the commissioner or the director in the states where they're doing business, they can look at their records and know that they're being judged accordingly and how solvent they are so that the consumers in the other state will have their claims paid. Slide 9 answers a question that the chairman just asked. It's a 5-year accreditation cycle, and we're up again in 2017. Slide 10, this is where the fun begins and why we have such a long title. I apologize. I don't know why this slide did not get updated. Risk-based capital. Risk-based capital is the first part of the bill. And it's a method of measuring the amount of capital that an insurer has to support its overall business. So what we're basically looking at is the insurance company's surplus, or the amount of assets it has to pay the claims. We refer to it as its cushions or its elastic measure. It's a formula. It's looking at how much the insurance company has on it. Again, it's a formula that we look at to determine the size of the company, how much it has out there in underwriting as far as potential claims against what it has in the bank to pay the claims. And it varies company by company. We are updating the risk-based capital. It is effective, these standards, January 1st, 2015. There is no perfect number because it's a hypothetical minimum depending on the insurance company. And this would be in the bill. It's about the first 8 pages. It's 2114. We already have a statute. We already have a chapter in Title 21 referred to as risk-based capital. This is amending. This is not new. This is amending and updating Chapter 14. The second part is insurance holding company. Again, this is an updating of our insurance holding company chapter. And this is updating more to reflect the status or the organizational structure of holding companies and letting us look at what a holding company may have besides an insurance company. And if there's more than one insurance company within that holding company, we would be able to see the finances of each holding or each company within the holding company to see that they're not subsidizing each other or that one is having a financial problem that could possibly impact the other.
So when you say you look at this information, is it something you have to apply to get, or is it online, or is it hard copy files? How do you actually go through that?
In some aspects, they have to report to us, and in one part of this bill, the ORSA, they will now have to report to us through a risk management framework. It's called an own risk solvency that they will be asked to report to us. They are required to report to us, and we do physical financial examinations of our insurers each year.
Thank you.
The next, again, is the risk management and own risk solvency assessment, and this is a new chapter into Title 21. It'll be Chapter 23 if this bill is approved, and this does put an onus on the insurance companies to report back to the division on confidential matters involving their enterprise risk management, so to speak, a forward-looking of acquisitions they may be looking at, their growth, where they expect to go, just things that we normally would not get in today's current financial examinations. And they would report this annually to us.
Ms. Winghar, then, do you sign confidentiality agreements then?
We have confidentiality built into the statute. It's in 2106060, and we reference it back in the bill as it's written. We reference back to the current confidentiality standards.
So I have a follow-up to that. So does that apply to everybody in the division, or if it's in law, how does it apply to individuals who are state employees?
It would apply to everyone within the division. It would apply to our contractors that we may hire as far as financial examiners and such, that we do have to keep the documents confidential. And unless there were to be a reason that we were to, through the Attorney General's, to have to give them up.
Thank you.
On slide 13, the operating requirements for controlling insurance producers. This, again, is an update to Chapter 27. And what this is basically doing is that it's setting out the parameters for if you own the insurance company and are also selling the insurance of the insurance company, and dictating when you have to basically draw the line between you're the owner of the insurance company and the agent. And that is a very high-level overview of the very long title of Section Bill, or Senate Bill 107.
Senator Stevens.
Well, thank you. Complex issue, certainly. So it is your responsibility to decide which insurance companies can do business in Alaska and which ones can't. I mean, you're looking at solvency and deciding, making that recommendation, or you can deny insurance companies to do business in Alaska?
Through the chair, yes, sir, we can, Senator Stevens.
And it appears like all we're talking about is solvency. What about, if say an insurance company denied all, does that enter into your equation as well? Because you say at the beginning that your job is to represent the consumer or to protect the consumer. So it's more than just solvency, right, that you're determining whether a company is should do business in Alaska.
Through the chair, I'm not sure I understood the question. Denied all.
This is coming from somebody who has no understanding of insurance. But you say at the beginning that your job is to protect the consumer, mm-hmm. and all we're really talking about here is solvency of the company, and that's certainly important, essential. But also, isn't it important whether the customers are being served?
Through the chair, absolutely, very much, which is one of the reasons I serve on the consumer protection or the market regulation. We have, part of my staff, there's consumer services within the department. We also have fraud and investigations. We have market conduct, or within our statute, we have fraud and investigations and unfair trade practices within our statute that we certainly enforce when a company comes in. But to have them come into get a certificate of authority to conduct business within the state, they have to meet certain financial solvency requirements. To continue to operate within the state, they have to meet certain financial solvency requirements. Then, after they're allowed to do business, how they operate, we certainly monitor their best practices, so to speak, that they're treating consumers fairly, paying claims when they should, responding to them. Absolutely, sir.
I see. Thank you. So this is the first step, the solvency.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
I have a question about the new chapter, and is it uncommon to have the model, the, you know, the legislation that's created through this very thorough process, is it uncommon to have a new chapter proposed? And then could you explain the rationale behind it? Why do we need a new chapter? Why is this new?
Madam Chair, the NAIC, when they drafted this model law, as the financial examiners, we thought that when we went in, there was so much that more that we wanted to know about insurance companies. So much what we do is looking backwards at what they have paid, what they have on the books looking backwards, but we were really not getting a forward-looking look at what they plan to be 5 years out or 3 years out. And this having them report to us looking forward of what they might be doing for acquisitions and their corporate governance and where the where they might be going as far as their growth, possible acquisitions they could be making. That's what that report will give us. And from there, then we can plan with them. Perhaps within that report, we could see a concentration of market that we don't particularly like. It would give us some things that we could work with them ahead of in advance, as opposed to being reactive. We could be more proactive working with an insurance company. Because a financial examination, it's looking back. This is going to be looking forward. And is it uncommon? It's not unheard of us. It's quite rare for us to have a new chapter, but it's not unheard of.
And was there a situation that precipitated this?
Not a true situation. It was just a need to put in address looking forward, and we could not see just putting it on to any one particular title that we had within or of a chapter, so we created a new. It didn't seem to fit within anything we currently had, so we created a new chapter.
Great. Okay, seeing no other questions, thank you very much. Appreciate all your work. I will now, Senator Ellis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not directly on point to the presentation or the legislation, but it is related. Madam Director, do you have a, or what is your position on rate review authority by the Division of Insurance? Because it does play into many of these issues.
Through the chair, it does, and we do rate review very carefully. I mean, we take, there's not a rate that comes into the state on property casualty, life and health, most products. We have rate review authority. It has to come through so many days in advance. We respond. They cannot be inadequate, they cannot be excessive, and they cannot be unfairly discriminatory, which are often looked at as being terms that are ambiguous or that they're people look at one way and don't necessarily understand as the way they're applied in statute, because what I can look at as being not excessive to someone who's paying the rate can be excessive. Mm-hmm. When I see it as not being inadequate, somebody else can say it's more than adequate. And so by statute, what I'm looking at is to say, does it make the company solvent? Does it, when I look at what they think their claims are going to be based on what their projections are going to be for number of people that are going to buy the product, number of claims they may pay, the cost of what those claims are going to be from the providers of whatever the product may be it health insurance or auto insurance, the demographics of where they're going to sell the product, taking in all those factors, inflation and what have you, is it adequate and still not excessive? It's something that, yes, we take very seriously, and it comes up frequently in when we look at what we're doing. But, no, we use a consulting actuary, and we have an actuary on staff. We have another gentleman who is going through, or two, that are looking to become actuaries, and it's a full-time job for us. We take it very seriously. We never want to see a consumer pay too much, but to have them pay too little – means that we will have insurers who are either pulling out of the market and we won't have a competitive market, or we'll have insurers that are insolvent. So we're walking a fine line of keeping the market stable. And I know that there's times where consumers think that rates are too high, but it's keeping the insurer solvent to make sure that there's a market there.
Madam Chair, if I could continue just a little bit.
Absolutely.
Thank you for the response, Madam Director. The thought from time to time around here has been that the situation may require more robust rate review authority on your part. Some have accused previous directors of doing nothing more than a cursory review of the filings and the requests from the insurer. And the particular interest has been in health care, health insurance. And, of course, Alaska is a very small market. You know, a company can write more business in San Jose, California than they could in the entire state of Alaska. That may be an exaggeration, but, you know, we are admittedly a very small market, and so we have to balance these things out, and that rests on your shoulders or the people that have been your predecessors. Several years ago, there was some money available, federal funds available, to allow states to figure out why, in the area of health insurance, consumers were being charged certain rates. And, of course, here in Alaska, we pay much higher insurance rates, and we pay much higher health care costs in the state of Alaska. And it confounded me why Linda Hall, who was recognized as a good commissioner of insurance over the time, she was very likable and made very good presentations and was sort of a fixture around these halls, and we wish her well in her retirement. But she turned down the money. I don't know if that was a direction from then the governor at the time, her boss. But it was almost willful ignorance of why. And legislators often ask the question of why in the world do our people in the state of Alaska pay so much for health care and health insurance? And how can it be so much higher than just our neighbors to the south in Seattle? And when there was an opportunity to dig into that and find out why, we turned down the ability to dig into those facts and figures and have a better answer for our people, for our consumers and our constituents. So I would encourage you, if there's ever a chance to, again, in the future, to learn the facts and figures, I would hope you would be more open to that and not just approach it on some ideological basis, but to dig into the facts and figures. I sense that willingness on your part. We don't know each other well, but I would hope that would be the case. So rate review authority, we don't really have the data points and the factual basis to underlie such a policy change, and it is controversial and a difficult argument around here, but if there ever is an opportunity to find out why we pay so much more, I would hope that you would take advantage.
Through the chair, point well taken, Senator Ellis. Thank you.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple questions. And it may not pertain to the bill too much, but it pertains to insurance anyway. So do you think, do we have a competitive market here in Alaska? I mean, certainly auto insurance seems to be, there seems to be a lot of companies, but then on, as Senator Ellis said, when it comes to health insurance, it seems pretty limited.
Through the chair, Senator Myers, I would agree. In certain lines of business, I think we do have a competitive market. In personal lines, I think in most cases, auto and homeowners, I think there are a number of companies that if we lined them up and looked at them, I would say yes, the market would stand as competitive. On healthcare, no. We have very limited markets. And I would not say we had, on the same basis, I would not say it's competitive.
Okay. And then if I could follow up one more quick question.
Absolutely.
And I don't normally like to say names of companies, but I think it's okay because neither one have an office in Alaska. But at one time I had auto insurance with AIG, and then they went bankrupt or something. I'm not real sure what happened there. And then all of a sudden I noticed I was now with Farmers. Do you approve when one company goes bankrupt or has financial difficulties and either sells or gives their clients to another company? Do they does that go through you for your approval, or does that just happen?
Through the chair, it's not that we approve it, but it does go through us because the claims end up going into the guarantee associations, be it life and health or property and casualty. And that is also in Title 21. There is a separate guarantee association for both. And then basically the consumers and the insurance companies end up paying the claims of the insolvent insurers. We've had it a couple different times in Alaska for various insurance companies that have become insolvent, and then we have ended up paying the claims to the claimants accordingly.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Senator Giesel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Director, back to health care insurance. So the discussion in the past has been buying or allowing Alaskans to buy health insurance across state lines. In other words, companies that aren't approved by you, I guess. I'm probably getting this wrong because this is not my area of expertise, but but are approved in other states. You know, those states being able to sell here, would that lower the insurance costs because we'd have a more competitive market? And then I have heard the counter argument that, frankly, the insurance rates are set on the price of health care. The cost of health care is what drives the cost of the insurance for health care. Your thoughts?
Through the chair, Senator Giesel, that is pretty much correct. And it's a... it's an issue we're facing as a state, and I have been involved in several meetings with the Commissioner Davidson's staff, with Department of Labor, workers' compensation, because health care is something that we face, and also with Department of Administration. Health care is something that we face as a state. It's not a silo. Governor Walker certainly doesn't want us to look at it that way. And it's the cost of health care. You can look at it in a variety of different ways, be it what I regulate under the Division of Insurance, be it Department of Health and Social Service, Department of Labor for Workforce Development, if it's Department of Administration, what the employees' plans. The health cost of health care is very, very high. And Alaskans are paying it, or someone is paying it, through one program or another, employers through workers' compensation. I mean, there's just, you can slice and dice it a variety of different ways. It's high. And we're paying for it a number of different ways, and we are looking at it in more of a global, holistic method than we have prior. In the last 4 or 5 months, we have been starting to look at it a lot different than we have prior.
Thank you.
Senator Ellis?
Well, Madam Chair, that's just a, I guess, a request on my part to you and to the committee is for us to keep track of this and to have an ongoing dialogue with the director, because this has been a topic of concern for many, many years. We didn't take the opportunity, or the previous, a previous director didn't take the opportunity to find out why we pay so much higher health care costs, and it is a huge driver of our state budget, so it's our obligation to try and find that out. I'm glad the director is making an effort here, and we should have more discussion and maybe some regular updates, because it's in the purview of your committee, our committee, to work together on that important issue. But Director, is it your sense that, through the chair, of course, Director, is it your view then that the market, to Senator Meyer's question, that our market for health insurance is not competitive because the cost of health care is so high and escalating at beyond market rates or average rates, that health insurers don't want to write business here because we're a small market and because our health care costs are so out of whack with the rest of the country? That's, I mean, common sense would say that that has to be, those have to be the two largest factors.
Through the chair, you're right on both accounts, Senator Ellis. We're a small market, mm-hmm. and our cost of health care are very high. You're right on both accounts.
Okay. So getting to that question, Madam Chair, of why health care costs so much more here and is escalating at this exorbitant rate and driving private market budgets and our state public budget is a cause of alarm and concern, and we should get to the bottom of it as best we can in a partnership with the director.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Ellison. I've taken note of your request, and we'll follow up on it. Senator Giesel.
So, Director, are you also partnering with the Health Care Commission, who actually has done studies on the topic of the cost of health care in Alaska?
Through the chair, and through that, I've been working, yes, through the Department of Health and Social Services. Yes, ma'am.
Great. Thank you.
I would just like to piggyback on some of the questions that have gone into the healthcare arena. We have asked questions about transparency and have had commissioners in front of committees where we've said, you know, how do we get transparency as far as cost to the consumer? I mean, is there any way, can that be legislated where the cost of services has to be made public so that when the consumer is shopping around, we know what something's going to cost?
Through the chair, yes. I don't even think it has to be. Through the Affordable Care Act, there are provisions where the costs do have to be made public now. And our cost, as far as what the rates are, have to become effective. The data are effective. That's by statute. And I know after what we went through, as Senator Ellis was talking about in the rate reviews, we had many ask for our rate filings the day they were effective January 1st. So I know that those were reviewed by many on January 1st, or at least requested by several parties to take a look at. But the as far as the rates, when you're looking as the premium as for a provider and such, those should be given to you or be accessible now. If they're not, I'd be interested in knowing.
I'm talking about the cost of services. So,
yes.
For example, my son broke his arm, and we called several different doctor's offices, and we received from one in Fairbanks the actual cost of a cast and exactly what it would cost to, you know, the bill would be. And then in Anchorage, we were given a range that was quite large, and essentially no one in the process has an idea of what the billing is going to be, and we all have our stories of bills that just continue to arrive from people we don't even know had a role in the process. And it's, I think it's frustrating for every Alaskan, and I think the frustration will just continue to grow.
Through the chair, or Madam Chairman, we'll certainly take that under advisement. Thank you.
Thank you. And then I did have a request. You had mentioned in terms of the bill that there are, you know, we have the new chapter, and then we have the model legislation, and then those sections that are needed for accreditation. And would it be possible for you to provide to the committee some sort of maybe a color coding of which sections of the bill address the new, which sections of the bill are needed for accreditation, and which sections are model legislation, or a combination of all three, just so that we have a sectional that is somehow
sure. Yes,
where it's easy to identify why this particular section is there, because you did a great job of explaining overall that those points, but I think it would be helpful, at least for me, to have that. And I don't want to take your time now to have you go through each one and say, well, this is new and this is needed for accreditation, but I think that would be something helpful for the committee.
I can have it for you Monday, ma'am.
Oh, thank you very much. Great. Okay. We will now open public testimony on Senate Bill 107. Is there anyone here in Juneau who would like to testify? Okay. Seeing none. Is there anyone online who'd like to testify? Okay, seeing none, public testimony is closed. So we will be setting this bill aside and allowing members time to digest it more fully, and appreciate you coming to my office and all the work that you've done on this with the division. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I would take a brief at ease. Senate Labor and Commerce Committee is called back to order, and for the members, we have just passed out a new sectional, which we will be going over. This is the second hearing for Senate Bill 99, a comprehensive Title IV rewrite. The intent is to go through the sectional from the sponsor's staff, Mr. Kopp, take members' questions, and set the bill aside for further consideration. I did want to mention also that Carmen Gutierrez with the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority is online. She and Mr. Kopp will be alternating as we go through the sectional, so I'll let you handle that tag team approach. And I did want to mention I have a meeting at 2:30, so I will be stepping out, and Vice Chair Senator Giesel will take over if the meeting is still going on at that point. So with that, I also wanted to mention that Cynthia Franklin will be available for questions, and so will Jeff Jesse with the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. Of course, Cynthia is with the ABC board. So with that, Mr. Kopp.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chuck Kopp, staff to Senator Peter Michicki. You heard yesterday that the overall goal of the Title IV rewrite is to promote a fair business climate, protect the public safety and health of our community, and the end result being a Title IV that is understandable and accessible to the public, that promotes a fair and reasonable enforcement approach to the industry. It accomplishes this in three ways, which you will see repeated through the sectional: modifying the role and composition of the board, clarifying and simplifying the three-tier system of alcohol regulations with the manufacturers, the wholesalers, and the retailers, and then changing the penalty provisions to improve and promote effective law enforcement. So getting right into the sectional in front of the committee, Section 1 deals with the board appointments and qualifications. It sets how the board is appointed: one member from public safety, one from public health, and one that has lived in a rural area within the last 5 years or is currently in a rural area, and not more than two in the alcohol industry. This section also allows the governor, in making appointments to the board, to take into consideration the experience of the executive director. So if your executive director has a public safety background, they can give that public safety board term to a general member of the public and make arrangements so there's always a balance, recognizing the executive director has a strong influence on the board. Sections 2 and 3 are simply conforming amendments.
Yes, do you mind explaining what the current ABC board is?
The current ABC board, as defined in statute, I'll go right to it.
Just so that the members understand the change.
Yes, so the board, the numbers of the board haven't changed, Madam Chair. There's still five members of the board. There were in this proposal is also five. In the current 406020 appointment and qualifications, it states that two members of the board shall be persons actively engaged in the industry. No more than two members may be engaged in the same business, occupational profession. Three members of the board, at least one of whom shall reside in a rural area, shall represent the general public. So there's three members of the board, at least one in a rural area representing the general public, and then other qualifications about prohibited financial interests. So it's pretty general, and so this more carefully defines what those roles are: one role public safety, one public health, one rural area, and not more than two in the industry. And then the one factor that could affect that balance is the experience of the executive director. The governor can take that into consideration to keep the board balanced in representation. Is that
thank
good?
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. Sections 2 and 3 are simply changing the term chairman to chair. Section 4, speaking to the authority of the director, requires the director to prepare a budget for the board, and this includes everything for the administration and enforcement of the title, as well as education, training, and prevention activities. Section 5 is a conforming reference in the delegation of authority to the board. It just reflects the relocation from the powers limited to the board stated in Chapter 11 to where it's now located in Chapter 6. And it adds the term endorsements, which is also new. It was introduced yesterday by Mr. Jeff Jesse. Under this rewrite, endorsements are used to expand the boundaries of a licensed premises or the authorized activities. And you'll hear about that later from Ms. Carmen Gutierrez under sampling endorsements, hotel motel endorsements, large resort, and things like that, that just gives them more options. Section 6 also has to do with the powers and duties of the board, and it includes the language of 411070, which is speaking to powers limited to the board. And this relates to the exclusive power of the board to issue, renew, transfer, relocate, suspend, or revoke license, and adds references to endorsements. We'll hear a lot about endorsements because that's a new concept in this rewrite. Section 7 adds new subsections to 46090, powers and duties of the board, and it requires the board to develop a comprehensive plan to educate the public on the responsible use of alcoholic beverages and to update this plan annually. It requires the board to review the fees established in Title IV and the regulations in Title IV at least every 10 years. And it says that the board may prepare an advisory opinion on legislation amending Title IV. So any legislation submitted that would affect the Title IV, the board may submit an advisory opinion. Section 8 deals with the statewide database, which is not new. That is going on now, but it speaks to the database on shipments to purchasers in local option areas, requires retention of the records for 10 years. Right now it's currently 1 year, and this was an agreed upon through this consortium of folks that it is better to do this for 10 years for both public safety and for the industry's data keeping purposes. And it adds a new reference to the packaging store shipping endorsement, which Carmen will speak to later. Section 9 requires the board to produce a report of aggregated regional and statewide data from the database, which would include the volume of alcohol shipped to communities and the region from which those shipments originated. And this is the way they keep track of what's going in and out of local option areas. With that, I'll turn it over to Ms. Carmen Gutierrez.
Good afternoon. This is Carmen Gutierrez, for the record, and I am on contract with the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority to work on this Title IV legislative rewrite. I would first like to convey my sincere apologies for not being able to be there in person, and please feel free to interrupt me at any time if there's a question or clarification that I might be able to make. So I'm going to start with Section 10, which is on pages 5 of the bill and actually runs through page 26. And basically what Section 10 does is it takes the current licensing provisions found in current AS 4.11.080 through 11.255. It revises, reorganizes, and relocates to a new chapter, which is now designated as 4.09. And the reason the new chapter is created is because there were such significant revisions that were needed to the licensing chapter that the only way to really implement the very badly needed reorganizational structure was to create the new chapter. So as you heard yesterday, Alaska's alcohol licensing system is based upon the three-tier system of alcohol regulation. And the three types of licenses the board may issue are manufacturer, wholesale, and retail licenses. And this new Chapter 9 encompasses the manufacturer, wholesale, and retail, as well as endorsements and permits, which I'll be talking about in a moment. So, without going through every provision that is in Chapter 9, I will highlight the major changes that this chapter provides. All the licensing types that were available for manufacture continue to exist. We have brewery, winery, and distillery. We continue to have wholesale licenses, general wholesale license, and limited, which is limited to malt beverage and wine. And then we have the retail licenses. The new chapter simplifies the manufacturing licenses by removing bottling works and brew cups. Bottling works is now essentially covered under the winery license. And the brewery manufacturing license incorporates most of the brew pub provision. Section 9.270 as retail licenses specifically for the manufacturers to permit these businesses the opportunity for limited on-site consumption and off-site sales, and also provide for separate endorsement for free samples. This new provision really reflects the changes in the market and provides breweries with an opportunity to showcase their products. It also ensures that the market between the retailers and the manufacturers does not become lopsided. And it provides equity between all manufacturers and permits wineries and breweries to have a restaurant eating place license. This section or chapter also removes the restriction on prohibited financial interest that is found in 411-450. This provision previously did not permit manufacturers to hold a restaurant eating place license, and with the elimination of manufacturers have been eliminated from 450 to permit them to do so. The new chapter makes population limitations applicable only to retail tier licenses, and this excludes tourism and public convenience license provisions. It also places a permanent moratorium on issuing new public convenience licenses and replaces existing public convenience licenses with a new license type that allows for seasonal restaurant eating place licenses in small communities and unincorporated areas. And this is important because it reflects the increase in Alaska's population during our tourism season. Our new chapter clarifies the parameters that would allow and require multiple fixed counters for a beverage dispensary license. And what that means is that there are a number of licensees in the state of Alaska that hold a beverage dispensary license. And within one contiguous roof, they may have more than one counter or bar that dispenses alcoholic beverages. We have created an endorsement that will really simplify how licensees are able to obtain an additional beverage dispensary counter under one contiguous roof. And we also have created a multiple fixed counter endorsement, a hotel-motel endorsement, and a large resort endorsement. And I will be talking about these endorsements in just a moment, so I'd like to hold off, though, on that specific discussion for just another moment. What Chapter 9 does, though, with the multiple fixed counter endorsement is it eliminates the duplicate licensing system, which created an opportunity for great expansion of the dispensing of alcohol in a number of for a number of licensees. But those licensees who have duplicate licenses, however, are grandfathered in. So it's not going to impinge upon the business activity of those who've been engaged and have relied upon certain licenses. This new chapter adds a beverage dispensary tourism license and a seasonal restaurant or restaurant eating place license. Again, as I stated earlier, this recognizes Alaska's population increase during the summer and provides operators with an opportunity to meet the needs of Alaska's seasonal travelers. The chapter ensures that the definition of recreation license is applied to current and potential recreational site holders, and there is a sunset provision to review and revoke any licenses that do not actually meet the plain language of the definition of recreation. Importantly, this chapter updates in every licensee provision, as well as in the endorsements and the permits. The specific fees have been reviewed and updated. And the goal with the licensee fee structure is to ensure that the fees are proportionate to the administrative costs of each kind of license, and hopefully will permit the state to collect sufficient revenue to cover the ABC statutory required activities. The fees have been adjusted for both wholesale licensees to retain...
Excuse me, Ms. Gutierrez?
Yes.
I have been following along, and it seems like you've been on Section 10 this entire time. Am I incorrect?
Section 10 the entire time, because this one section provided for extensive revisions, and I felt that of all the sections, this is one that probably requires the most explanation.
No, and I appreciate the explanation. I just want to make sure that when you do get to Section 11, that the members can follow along with the section on. And so, please, I think this is very helpful.
And, Madam Chair, that Section 10 is page 5 through 44.
Please continue, Ms. Gutierrez.
Thank you. Yes, and when I come to Section 11, I will definitely indicate to the committee that I'm there.
Thank you.
The new Chapter 9, particularly starting on page 25 of the bill, specifies penalties for noncompliance and operating without a license. Our goal was, before, under the previous Chapter 11, there was nothing in Chapter 11 to explain to the public or to an industry member or any interested stakeholder what the penalties were for noncompliance. You had to know to look in a different chapter, which was Chapter 16. So under the rewrite, we made an effort to make sure that the penalties for violating any provision of Chapter 9 were actually outlined in that same chapter. So on page 25 of the bill at line 30, it outlines the penalties for noncompliance and for operating without a license. Operating without a license is a Class A misdemeanor, and for every act of not complying with a particular requirement of the provision is considered a minor offense. And the committee, the group that worked on the sanctions for noncompliance and reviewed Alaska court system data, and based upon that review, we came to the conclusion that by making noncompliance a minor offense would encourage more proactive enforcement, that if you're selling alcohol without the required license, that definitely needs to continue to be a Class A misdemeanor offense. So then we have a section in Chapter 9 that creates the system of endorsements, to which both Chuck and I have earlier referred. And you'll find that at page 26 through 38 of the bill, specifically sections 09.360 through 0.470. And the endorsements are intended to expand the boundaries of a licensed premise or authorize additional activities of a licensed business. And there's a whole list of endorsements that are now included in this one section. And as I said earlier, the goal of these endorsements, which are subject to review by the board, is to permit licensees to engage in activities that are now much more prevalent in the industry. And then lastly, at page 38 through page 43 of the bill, specifically sections 9.500 through 600. It creates and updates the permit and places all permits in statute and not in regulation. And with regard to licenses, endorsements, and permits, the statute is very clear, or the language in Chapter 9 is very clear that the board may only issue licenses, endorsements, and permits that are outlined in statute. So, moving on to Section 11, are there any questions regarding the licensing system or the system of endorsement or permits before I move on? With regard to Section 11, which is page 44 through 45 of the bill, this section is amending 4.11.010 to eliminate the selling and manufacture, the prohibition of selling and manufacturing alcohol with a license. It's omitted from 010 because, as I noted earlier, we have that same prohibition now in Chapter 9, the selling without a license, selling without an endorsement, or selling without a permit. So 010 is amended to reflect that change. Sections 12 and 13 are essentially conforming amendments. Section 14 on page 45, line 6, provides a fine of $100 for an individual who purchases alcohol from a non-licensed entity. We wanted to ensure that Title 4 specifically delineated the fines that would be imposed for anyone violating provisions in Title 4. We wanted to ensure that the courts were not able to suspend those fines, and we further wanted to ensure that a suspended imposition of sentence could not be imposed by the court. And then with regard to Section 15, page 45, line 9, this section adds a new subsection to 4.11.015C, changing the penalty for purchasing alcoholic beverages from a non-licensee from the standard penalty for a violation that's outlined under 12.55, which was a maximum fine of $500, to a fine of $100 per liter purchase. So that if someone was purchasing a large quantity of alcohol, they're going to be assessed a penalty based upon the amount of alcohol actually purchased. On Section 16, found at page 45 of the bill, adds a specific criminal penalty provision for a person who transfers a license or permit or interest not in accordance with the statute, and that makes it a violation with a fine of $100. Section 17 addresses the penalty for the offense of unauthorized transfer of a license, and that is a violation with a penalty of $100. Section 18, found at page 45 of the bill, adds a specific criminal penalty for failure of a corporation to report a stock transfer, and that too is a violation. And Section 19, again, provides a specific penalty for failure of a partnership to report a partnership transfer of partner interest or change of general partner. That too is a violation. And Section 20 is basically just a conforming amendment. Section 21, found at page 46, addresses the penalty for failure to comply with a prohibited provision, which makes selling the fine, again, will be determined based upon the amount of alcohol transferred in violation of 060. But at this time, I'll turn it back over to Chuck.
Excuse me, Ms. Gutierrez, it sounds like you have questions from Senator Meyer.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, thank you for that presentation. And just a quick question. It seems like you use the fine amount of $100 frequently here. And like, for example, in Section 16, when you have the authorized transfer of alcoholic beverage license, that's a pretty, to me, that seems to be like a pretty serious offense. And I'm just wondering if a $100 fine is enough to deter that activity.
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, you raise a very, very good question. The penalty that we are discussing in the sections that I've just been through, basically 15 through 19, are dealing with the criminal penalties. But what is noteworthy is that the board has at its disposal administrative remedies that can be very severe indeed. The administrative penalties available to the ABC board include suspension of a license, revocation of a license. It also includes an administrative fine of up to $50,000. So the collective wisdom of the work group involved in the review of Title IV sanctions believe that these kinds of violations could be better addressed by the ABC board than by the criminal justice system. And so for that reason, the criminal fines are low indeed, but they represent very significant remedies are available to the board administratively. The other change that we'll be discussing later in the Title IV rewrite is that the court system now will be required to send any judgment of conviction to the ABC board, so the board will know any time any licensee has been convicted of a criminal violation under Title IV.
Okay. Follow-up, Senator Meyer?
No, I'm good. And I know a lot of smarter people than I have been involved in this. It just seemed like whenever you set a dollar amount like that, then over time with inflation, it either need to adjust it or it is too low. And so, but no, I'm fine with that, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Gutierrez. This is Vice Chair Senator Giesel. Chair Senator Costello was called away, so I'll be presiding for the rest of the meeting.
Thank you very much.
So have you completed your section? We're moving now to Mr. Kropp.
Yes, thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
And thank you. If I may, Madam Chair, I'll just refer to you as Madam Chair. And through the chair, Senator Meyer, there can be more technical reasons why a transfer may not be authorized, and there's then more nefarious reasons. And like Ms. Gutierrez said, the fine can be up to $50,000, suspension or revocation of a license. So there's just a whole range of behavior, and they are required by law now to review these fees every 10 years. You mentioned inflation. So Madam Chair, again, you're writing to Section 22, application for new license and permit. This would apply to any individual, corporation, or partnership that's applying for a license or an endorsement, and what those requirements are. It does include that they need to have an annotated illustration of the premises they're proposing to license and other things that are spelled out there. Section 23 is application for renewal of a license or permit, and this specifically covers renewal of specified endorsements, which Carmen just covered. Section 24 deals with the criminal justice information and records system, and it relates to an applicant submitting their fingerprints to the criminal justice information system required for issuance and renewal of their permits, licenses. Section 25 speaks to the definition of applicant, and it relates to applications for insurance and renewal of a conditional contractor's permit. Conditional contractor's permits are two-year licenses, like for construction sites in remote areas or inside boundaries of military reservations that are not inside a municipality. Section 26, it adds a new section, 411.315, which speaks to a false statement on an application. It's relating to the crime of making a false statement. And what it does is it repeals existing language. The penalty is the same. It's a B felony, just like it was before. But what we found in review of this title is that the conduct prescribed in Title 11 for perjury was different than the conduct prescribed in Title 4. And they needed to be reconciled. Perjury is perjury in either statute. So we reconcile the language. The penalty is the same, a class B felony for perjury. Section 27 amends 411.320 relating to denial of licenses by the board to encompass the denial of endorsements as well. Section 28 amends 411.330A, which is denial of licenses and permits renewal, and this includes the denial or renewal of an endorsement. It requires the board to decline an application for renewal of a beverage dispensary tourism license or a seasonal restaurant or eating place tourism license if the board finds the licensee is not encouraging the tourist trade, because that is, in fact, the purpose of that. Section 29 is a conforming reference to a section that is now in Title 4, Chapter 9. Section 30 speaks to the denial of request for relocation. Grounds for refusal of an application for relocation of a license to add a reference to the new Title 4, Chapter 9, requiring denial of applications to relocate outdoor recreation lodge licenses. And then Section 31 changes references in 411.360. This is speaking to denial of transfer of a license to another person. This is the statute that speaks to these denials and requires a denial of request to transfer outdoor recreation lodge licenses. The idea here is that a recreation lodge license stays with the life of the owner, and they will eventually be sunsetted out. But as long as that licensee still has it, they are grandfathered in, but it may not transfer to a new person or location. We'll now turn it over to Carmen.
Thank you. So I'm now on Section 32, and this deals with licensed premises located in residential housing developments that are owned by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, and it amends this provision, adding the new restaurant eating place endorsement provision that I talked about a few minutes ago. Section 33 relates to the power of the board. The ABC board obviously has the power to suspend or revoke a license, and this provision is amended to include endorsement. Section 34, the board, 411.395, addresses the board's authority to impose conditions or restrictions on a licensee. And this provision includes the new endorsement and gives them the same ability to impose conditions or restrictions on endorsement. Section 35 amends 411.400. This is an important provision that deals with the population limit. And what it does is it adds a limit of one brewery retail, winery retail, or distillery retail per 100,000 people, 10,000. And it adds a radius, a 10-mile radius to the population limit. Bill 36 on page, I'm sorry, Section 36 at page 57 of the bill, this section, as currently written, excludes golf courses from the population limit statute. this statute has been under this revision, or it's a repeal and reenactment, to include a list of 9 license types and 1 permit type that are not encompassed under the population limit. I won't outline those 9 license types and the 1 permit type, but you'll see them listed at page 57 of the bill, lines 18 through 31. Section Section 37 is a conforming reference in the population limit provision that provides the new statutory citation for a beverage dispensary license. Section 38 is an amendment to 411-450B, which addresses the prohibited financial interest issue that I addressed earlier. It eliminates Buckling Works and brew pubs, since those will no longer exist in Chapter 9, and it adds a sentence that prohibits the issuance of a restaurant or eating place license to an owner of a hotel business or distillery. Distilleries may not have a restaurant eating place license, since those are limited solely to beer and wine. Section 39 is a conforming language. Section 40 is amendment 411-470, which is a provision that addresses public objections to a license issuance, and it just is adding endorsements to that. Section 41 amends 411-488, a public protest provision, to include endorsements. Section 42 also addresses the public protest process to include endorsements. And the same is true with Section 43. It expands the provision to include the new endorsements in Chapter 9. So, Chuck, I'll turn it over to you now.
Okay. Thank you, Karen. Madam Chair, Section 44, we get right into the next 4 sections, are conforming changes. They speak to the local option in Section 44 for a municipality and a repealer of the prohibition of sale and importation of alcohol beverage. This is one prohibition that the committee and the consortium decide didn't really make sense. They're one that prohibits only the sale and importation, but not possession. So, in other words, only if the Tooth Fairy brought you the alcohol, could you have it, because sale and importation. So they decided to do away with that, so we see that repealed here. Section 45 very similarly addresses the local option in established villages and repeals that same section. Section 46 is also a conforming amendment in the ballot wording requirements for local option elections. And Section 47 makes conforming amendments to the local options in both municipality and established village elections. It is currently only a C felony because of local option in this, some of this conduct here. Otherwise, it would not be a crime. And this addresses some issues that make things a crime just because it's a local option area. Section 48, Madam Chair, speaks to effect on licenses of prohibition of sale. So if you are speaking to sale of alcoholic beverages in a local option area on existing licenses, this is, makes conforming references and reflects renumbering in the new section it's found in. It expands the boundaries of the area from 5 to 10 miles from those municipalities that have adopted a local option. It prior was their circle, if you will, was 5 miles beyond that established village or municipality. Now it's out to 10 to keep the importation of alcohol even further away from that area. and adds an exception permitting renewal of existing outdoor recreation lodges. This recognizes the recreation lodge industry in Alaska is very significant. People come from all over the world, and there's substantial investments made all throughout Alaska, and if all of a sudden an area becomes a local option area, this would allow that business to continue in that area. And you'll see that again in Section 49 that allows an exception to the prohibition on importation for outdoor recreation lodges. So again, if you're in an area that has a local option, you can still bring alcohol into that lodge. Section 50 creates an exception to the prohibition on possession of alcohol in a dry community for outdoor recreation lodge licensee holders, agents, employees, and guests. So those sections, specifically 48, 49, and 50, deal with outdoor recreation lodges and how they're grandfathered in here. Section 50 adds a reference to 411-501A and 411-501B. And this is simply the prohibition of possession after an election has occurred. And what this says is that the prohibition under A of this section on possession is effective 90 days after the results of an election is certified. So if you're possessing in that area, you have 90 days to consume your alcohol or get rid of it if you're now in a dry area. Section 52 amends 411-503, which relates to the effect of these local option elections restricting sale on existing licensees. So their licenses would expire 90 days after they become a local option area. And it does permit the board to renew existing outdoor recreation lodge licenses and provides that the lodge licenses are not void 90 days after the results of a local option election are certified. And again, expands the boundary of the area from 5 to 10 miles out of the perimeter of the established village or municipality, whereby alcohol commercial activity cannot exist. Section 53 amends 411-505, which changes the local option radius out to 10 miles and permits renewal of existing outdoor recreation lodges areas only in areas that opt to allow only licensed premises operated by a municipality. Right now, I believe it's Kotzebue that has a municipality that operates its licensed premises. So this is speaking to exceptions to premises operated by municipalities. Section 54 speaks to the establishment of perimeter of an established village. And here we see it expands the perimeter of a local option area for an established village from 5 to 10 miles. Section 55, we're now on page 65 of the bill, conforms references in 411-509B, which reflects the repeal of 411-491A, 4, and B3. So this is the section that deals with the notice of the results of a local option election, how those results are published, and it's specifically reflecting the repeal of the municipal sale and importation option and the village sale and importation option. Section 56 amends 411-520 to limit the requirement of notice to local government just to applications for issuance or renewal of a license or endorsement. This was not limited before. Also speaks to transfer of a license to another person or new location. So you have to give notice to that local governing body for the license application the first time or issuance, renewal, an endorsement, transfer to another person or location. It limits it to those particulars. Section 57 speaks to suspension and revocation based on acts of employees, and it includes the references to endorsements and permits, which are, of course, permits are always think of catering and serving activities, and that's basically what the permits have to do with when they're done off license premises. Section 57 is application of precedent of the board, and it covers issuance and renewal of an endorsement. The application of precedent section of the law simply says that the board is not bound by prior decision. They can always look at the facts of the case in front of them and make a determination at that point. And that's currently in the law now. This just adds endorsements. Section 59, it includes and amends 411-5402 include endorsements again. This is license renewal and expiration. Section 60 is also conforming just to add the inclusion of endorsements in the section that speaks to appeals, appealing to the Superior Court against license actions taken by the board. Section 61 is speaking to the refund and forfeiture of fees and specifically to include endorsements and permits. Under what circumstances are fees refunded? Section 62 speaks to the surrender and destruction of a license, and it adds endorsements because they can also be surrendered and destroyed if a violation occurs. And then finally, Section 63, speaking to disposition of money, would include money, fines, and fees that goes to Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. They, in turn, deposit it into the general fund, and the legislature then may make appropriations back to them to carry out Title IV, and this would pick up also money coming from endorsements and permits. So, Madam Chair, there are no questions on those sections. We can go to back to Carmen.
Very good. Questions? Senator Stevens.
On page 63, I'm fascinated by that subject about voters decide that they're going to prohibit importation. It says that you can't ship liquor, anything like transports in. The exception is Sacramento wine, which is quite interesting, I think. But the second one is what really I don't quite understand. Has to do with Outdoor Recreation Lodge, so that even if the voters prohibit importation, a lodge can import alcohol. Is it? Am I reading that right?
Through the chair, yes, Senator Stevens. This was a agreed upon exclusion by the whole consortium, which included, you know, public safety, law, and all the industry, that those lodges would be given an exception if they were already established in that area and operating lawfully, that otherwise no action had been taken against their license. They were in good standing. But it does grandfather out. It does not permit. It only stays with the life of the licensee. Do I have that right, Carmen?
Through the chair, Representative Senator Stevens, what this provision does, under current law, an individual with a that is located in a area that has voted to limit the sale or transportation of alcoholic beverages, lodges are permitted to provide alcoholic beverages to their guests. And what this amendment does is it increases the boundary of the lodge to within 10 miles of the boundary of the municipality or the perimeter of the established village. And the board has the right to review a license, an outdoor recreation lodge license, to continue that licensee's ability to provide their guests with alcoholic beverages. And I do not believe that there's any grandfather provision with regard to the Outdoor Recreation Lodge licensee's ability to provide alcoholic beverages to their guests only.
So, Carmen, and through the chair, Senator Stevens, I think your question was, is this a permanent exclusion, or does it end at some point in time? Is that a fair?
That's part of it, certainly.
Okay. Can you answer that, Carmen?
It does not end. If an outdoor recreation lodge has a license to provide alcoholic beverages to their guests, their right to do so continues as long as they're properly issued a license. Their right is not, it does not terminate after a specified period of time.
Follow-up?
I think I understand what you're saying, but I'm not sure I agree with you. I mean, if a community decides they want to be dry, why would there be an exception? Why would we allow a lodge to provide liquor in a town that doesn't want it?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, part of the answer to that question, those communities were represented in this consortium. We had rural Alaska represented and people from, you know, local option communities on this. I personally didn't sit through all those subcommittees. Carmen, maybe you have a better answer of how they came to maybe the background of the discussion that occurred that led up to this exception.
There was a subcommittee that was a local option subcommittee, and that committee was composed of individuals who live in rural communities. And it was decided that having lodges provide their customers only with alcohol beverages was not going to be an impingement on the purpose and the underlying intent of local option prohibition. And furthermore, the lodge has to ship the alcohol in, so it is importing, and so for that reason we needed the exception. But they're not selling the alcohol to the general public. They are only providing it to guests who in many cases pay large sums of money to go to these lodges and have their Alaska outdoor experience. So I was not involved in the local options subcommittee, but I do know that this provision was vetted by that subcommittee and was approved by the entire steering committee that oversaw the entire process.
Well, Madam Chair, I understand what you're saying, but that's not what you say customers only, but it does not say customers only. You say not to the public. It does not say not to the public. So, I mean, I'll drop the subject, but it seems to me that, democracy is if a community decides that they want no alcohol in their community, you're leaving an opening for customers, not people who are not customers of the lodge, and also to the public. I mean, am I misreading this, and why doesn't it say customers only?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, at page 18 of the bill at line 17, that is where the outdoor recreational lodge license exists. And what it says is it permits the holder of the license, and I misspoke, to sell alcoholic beverages to a registered overnight guest or off-duty staff of the lodge for consumption on the licensed premises or in conjunction with purchased outdoor recreation activities provided by the licensee. So, under provision 409.240.
And why don't you tell me the line number, if you would, please?
Oh, certainly. It's line 17, sir.
Okay.
17 through 19. So that provision provides you with a definition of the prohibited activity, a definition of what an outdoor recreational lodge is. And it outlines the perimeter.
Follow-up, Senator Stevens?
Yeah, I think I've had enough of that, but
okay.
I can't say I agree with you, because it does say off-duty staff, so that could be people who actually live in the village. And anyway, if everyone is happy with that, I guess I'm okay with it. Thank you.
Madam Chair, for the record, I think also that Cindy Franklin, who is the executive director, is online, and she was involved in substantial. She may have some comment, and also Jeff Jesse, I believe, is online.
Thank you, Mr. Kopp. Cynthia did have to sign off. Cynthia, are you back on? No, she is not. Mr. Jesse, are you on the line? He is not either. Okay. So, Senator Stevens, perhaps you would want to flag that for question at our next meeting.
Thank you.
All right.
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, I would also refer you to the current statute, which is 411.225, which apparently this provision has been in place since 2005.
All right. Thank you. If no further questions from committee members, Mr. Kopp, are you proceeding or is Ms. Gutierrez?
Okay, Madam Chair, let me give me just a moment. Which section were you on, Carmen?
64.
So we are now on
yes.
Section 64.
So Carmen will proceed, yes.
All right. Ms. Gutierrez, if you would proceed, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I am now on page 68 of the bill, section 64. And 411.610 is a provision that talks about the biennial fees that licensees pay and how that money is allocated to the municipality. The current statute uses the term refund. That's really an incorrect term. So this provision amends the statute to use the term allocation instead of refund. And then subsection B is amended to provide that if a municipality fails to provide the ABC board director with a report of violations of any Title IV violation occurring in the municipality, that the Commissioner of Commerce and Community and Economic Development may deny the municipality an allocation of those licensing fees. Section 65 pertains to 411.630, which is the access to inspection, and it requires, in addition to licenses, that need to be posted, that endorsements and permits also be posted on the designated premise. Section 66 addresses 411.680, and it, which is the statute providing seasonal licenses, and it amends that provision to include sampling and conditional contractor permits. Section 64 deals with amending the statute that provides for the hours of sale in the presence of individuals on licensing premises. And that statute was a bit restrictive in that it does not permit individuals who are working to improve their licensed premises by conducting construction activities. And so it's been amended so that individuals who are conducting business with the licensee, a person who's a common carrier or a maintenance and construction worker, can be on the licensed premises during normally closed hours, hours in the public cannot be served alcoholic beverages. Section 68 further amends that that same provision to make noncompliance a violation, which is punishable by a fine of $100 for each hour or part of an hour that an individual is on premises in violation of the provision. Section 69 amends the statute to include and add the concept of an alcoholic drink. And alcoholic drink is now defined in the definitional section found in Chapter 21. Section 70 amends the provision that provides for how pricing and the marketing of alcoholic beverages is to occur. It makes it a crime if you don't properly adhere to the statute. That crime is a violation, and it is punishable by a fine of $50 per drink sold in violation of the provision. Section 71 adds a new provision that relates to unfair trade practices, and this provision is modeled after federal federal law, and the attempt here is to align state law with federal law regarding unfair trade practices between agreements that retailers and wholesalers and manufacturers might make with one another. And then I think now it's time for me to turn it back over to Chuck.
Okay, Madam Chair. Section 72 adds subsections to 416.020, which makes solicitation of alcohol beverages and purchase on behalf of someone else a violation punishable by $100. You can't encourage a patron in your bar to buy another beer for someone who's not on the premises. Or you can't allow someone loitering on your premises begging for you to buy the beer. A licensee cannot allow that to happen, or to buy alcohol for someone in a local option area. Section 73 adds references to 416.025, which is the illegal presence on premises involving alcohol beverages. This just simply says that these violations are relate to entering and remaining on premises where the illegal sale of alcohol is occurring, and that has to do with being on an unlicensed premise or in violation of a local option. Section 74 adds crime and penalty provisions to existing 416.030, which is prohibited conduct relating to drunken persons. It makes this a violation rather than a Class A misdemeanor. This is the selling or giving alcohol to a drunken person, allowing another person to sell or give alcohol, allowing someone who is drunk to remain on premises, allowing a drunk person to sell or serve. One of the reasons for making this a violation rather than an A misdemeanor is because it can be very hard to determine at times at what point you cross the line from having a couple drinks to now you're kind of impaired to now you're kind of drunk. And it, a licensee or a server could literally be looking at a Class A misdemeanor for, and it's that the violation is a $250 base fine, and the board can make it substantially more. The other thing with the violation of the tickets, it comes immediately to the attention of the board, where a misdemeanor can be tied up in the courts for a very long time, and the board never finds out culpability. So this is a rapid turnaround on correcting behavior if there is a problem with over-serving. Section 75 amends 416.035 to apply the prohibition on possession of ingredients for homebrew to all local option areas. So you have to possess with intent to illegally brew beer under that. Section 76 adds new subsections to 416.035. This is the homebrew again, specifying that this possession is a Class A misdemeanor if you're possessing with intent to make homebrew in a local option area. Section 77 speaks to access of drunken persons to licensed premises, and it uses the defined term of licensed premises rather than the term of premises licensed under this title. This is a drafting style change to conform to established definitions in the definition section. Section 78 adds new subsections to 416.040, making access by a drunken person to licensed premises a violation. Section 79 speaks to the obligation of a licensee to enforce restrictions in the licensed premises. In other words, no unauthorized consumption on licensed premises, that's a violation, and each drink consumed in violation is punishable by a fine of $50. So anything that's not permitted by your license, the licensee has a responsibility to police that. Section 80 adds a subsection to 416.047, and this specifically speaks to persons who are restricted from purchasing alcohol. And if someone comes into your bar and they're court-ordered, that they have had a DUI or they had an alcohol-related crime and the court said you cannot go onto a bar or licensed premises, it's a Class A misdemeanor for that person to do that. With Section 81, I'll turn it back over to Carmen.
Thank you, Chuck and Madam Chair. The next section, sections 81 through 85, address minor consuming or the access of minors to licensed premises. But before I address those topics, I would like to indicate that currently under Title IV, specifically 416.180, virtually every act that violates some provision of the title is a Class A misdemeanor offense. And so what the Title IV Sanctions Subcommittee determined was that no law enforcement was occurring when Title IV was violated. Prosecutors are too busy. They didn't find these kinds of violations as egregious as many of the other crime violations that they're dealing with in their offices day in and day out. And so even when cases were actually filed with the court system, they would ultimately be dismissed. And enforcement through the criminal justice system was simply not happening. And when the criminal justice system was unable to enforce Title IV violations, that meant the board had at its disposal less ability to enforce the title. So the goal was to make many of these provisions minor offenses. That way prosecutors don't get involved. And then once the person, under this title, they're going to be enforced largely like a traffic infraction. And so if a person doesn't show up for court at the designated time, default judgment is entered, and the board is immediately given notification by the court system that a licensee has been convicted of a minor offense for violating some provision of Title IV. So with regard to Section 81, which is at page, actually at the top of page 74 of the bill, this is a provision that addresses access of minors to licensed premises, and there's some language change rather than using the verbiage, the age of. The bill is amended to use the verbiage of age. The access to licensed premises now includes the restaurant and eating place endorsement that we now have under the new Chapter 9. It also includes access of minors to a club license under Chapter 9. So those are the changes that are encompassed in Section 81, 82, and 83. Section 84 permits golf course operators to employ individuals who are 18, 19, or 20 years of age. Section 85, permits access by minors to golf courses for the purpose of playing golf, even if alcoholic beverages are served. They're on the golf course via one of those golf carts where they distribute alcoholic beverages. But if there is unauthorized presence of a minor on a golf course, the fine will be up $500. If a minor misrepresents his or her age and is served alcohol because of that misrepresentation, the minor will be punished by a fine of $500. But the court may reduce the fine to $50 if the minor shows proof of completion of an alcohol safety action program. So the goal here is, rather than dinging the minor with a $500 fine, the goal is to incentivize that minor to participate in an alcohol education program, and if they do so, the fine can be reduced. Section 86deals with a substantial change to the minor consuming statute found at 416.050. What it does is it repeals the current minor consuming statute and reenacts the provision making minor consuming a violation. The goal here is to not criminalize minor consumption and have minors who fail to comply with their alcohol safety action requirements end up in jail, which has been what is happening under the current provision. By also making it a minor offense, it will encourage law enforcement, for the reasons that I stated earlier, to prosecute these cases. If a law enforcement officer goes to a party and there are a number of minors who are there consuming alcohol, under current law, they have to do a record check of every minor, figure out whether or not the minor has a prior minor consuming, because that dictates how the case has to be charged. And what happens is law enforcement officers, due to the press and so much other business, they end up not citing these kids, and they're not, the minor consuming violations are not enforced. Under this new provision, none of that will be required. Law enforcement will simply write them a ticket. The youthful offender will either go to court and have a truck or pay the bail on the ticket, just like we do with a traffic infraction. And if they don't show up, they're assessed a fine of $500. It cannot be suspended. The only way that fine can be lessened is if they go to an alcohol safety action program and they complete the program within 6 months of their conviction date. And we're very encouraged by this new provision because we believe that many more minor consuming offenses are actually going to be filed with the court system. And although not prosecuted by prosecutors, individuals will be convicted and we hope incentivized to go to an alcohol education program.
Madam Chair.
Section 80.
Excuse me, Ms. Gutierrez, excuse me. Senator Stevens has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think it's probably a good idea, but I was just concerned, are there alcohol safety action programs, are juvenile alcohol safety action programs available in all communities, some communities? How are they distributed around the state?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, thank you for the question. The Department of Health and Social Services was involved, very involved, in the minor consuming subcommittee. And in fact, that subcommittee was chaired by Diane Castro of Health and Social Services. And Ms. Castro and her staff believe that they will be able to provide the alcohol education program to individuals throughout the state, even if it's done through online programs or study at home programs. So even if there is not an alcohol safety action program in a remote rural community, they believe that they can link that individual up to the nearest alcohol safety action program, and that entity will be responsible for monitoring the minor to ensure that he or she complete the designated course. But the Alcohol Safety Action Program is a monitoring entity, and then they will refer the individual to a program that is suitable for their location. Does that help answer the question?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Senator Meyer.
Thank you. Along those lines, I understand, too, why for minor consuming alcohol, we're reducing that to a $500 fine instead of a misdemeanor. Mm-hmm. As it is now, you know, not many of them actually get prosecuted because it is very costly and time-consuming. And as you said, it takes a lot of time for the officers. So they probably don't even mess with it. But at least the kids know now that it's a pretty serious offense. I'm just afraid if it's simply just a fine or violation that it may work the other way in the sense that, well, it's no big deal. We can just go ahead and drink. What was the thinking there? And I'm sure you looked at it both ways. Is this similar to how they do it in other states? I don't know.
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, I don't know how they do it in other states. But when we reviewed, when the minor consuming subcommittee reviewed court system data, they found that many of these cases were being dismissed and not prosecuted. And so the goal was to ensure that more minors are actually being convicted of the offense. The fine is going to come out of their PSD. Their parents are going to be notified and informed of the alcohol education programs that are available to the minor. And I think overall, it was definitely the consensus of the Minor Consuming Work Subcommittee that this is going to do more to get the attention of minors than our current system. Moreover, the minor consuming provision as it currently stands creates a status crime, and minors are, in some cases, when they are prosecuted and they don't comply with the Alcohol Safety Action Program requirements, they end up in custody. They're actually in jail. And in some cases, they can be in jail for 1 or 2 days for what is called a status offense. And when states create criminal provisions that result in minors being in custody, it can get us haywire with some of the federal funding that we receive. And so that was another concern that motivated this change to the minor consuming statute.
Further questions, Senator? I also want to make it known that Cynthia Franklin, the executive director of the ABC board, is online.
And through the chair, if I may ask Cindy to respond to the senator's question, because she may know how other states are addressing the issue. And but because of her role as a prosecutor for the municipality of Anchorage and her role on the Minor Consuming Subcommittee, she may be better able to answer the senator's question.
Ms. Franklin?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Cynthia Franklin. I'm the director of the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board, and I would be happy to address the question. I was on Guy and Casta's subcommittee prior to coming to the ABC board in my job as the Anchorage Municipal Prosecutor, and have worked extensively on the minor consuming issue. A few years ago, I was approached by Anchorage District judges who were very dissatisfied with some of the injustices that they were seeing occurring in the minor consuming scheme as it exists today in 416.050, and some of the inability of the judges to adjust or change those penalties for circumstances before them. I myself saw young people incarcerated whenever I worked at weekend duty for failing to appear in court, failing to do their action plan, their alcohol action plan or education course, and failing to report for community work service. So understanding that no young people are really supposed to be jailed in this country for a status offense, meaning an offense that is only a crime because of the individual's age versus actual criminal conduct, I was very concerned about the way that the minor consuming laws are currently working or not working in the state. The Underage Drinking Subcommittee did study some of the penalties in other states. However, the states are all over the board on this issue. We went to a juvenile justice conference in May of last year with several judges from the Alaska court system and learned there that any federal funding that a state receives could be jeopardized if it is determined that their status offense schemes incarcerate young people for status offenses. So we came back with an urgency to get this statute fixed. I do agree that on first glance it might seem that these penalties might not seem as serious, but my experience as the Anchorage Municipal Prosecutor is fines are effective penalties, and what is more effective than anything else is something that is consistently applied. So So if a young person is charged with a serious offense but the prosecutor declines the case, then there is no message to the young person. And we believe the entire underage drinking subcommittee, which had stakeholders from across all of the various interests in this, regulating the substance and making sure it stays out of the hands of young people, everyone ended up agreeing and concluding that this was a good approach to try because it's one that we can guarantee is going to be applied consistently. It's going to make the tickets easier to write, and it's going to decrease the number of places in the system where these charges can fall out and the young person ends up with no consequence whatsoever. So we really approached it with a little bit consistent consequence is better in the end and will work better in the end than a higher consequence that's inconsistently applied. And I do believe that this is that we will be amazed if this scheme is applied at right now, the system that we have, the data is showing that we're not making a difference with our current statute in decreasing the number of young people charged with this offense. So we hope there'll be a spike in tickets, and then once everyone understands that there's an actual consequence to this and understands that if they proactively approach this and try and go and get the course, they can substantially reduce their fine. We think that it has the best chance of being effective in this important issue. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Franklin. Further questions from committee members? Senator Stevens.
Just follow up on that. I think that's you've got a great idea there. I think it should be very helpful. What happens if a young person offends again after they've taken the program, the CDT Action Program, once, and it should happen a second time? Are there increased penalties? Yeah.
Through the chair, Senator Stevens. No, and the reason is because we have that escalating scheme now, and there are a couple of things about that do not work. First of all, determining whether or not the young person has been previously convicted is a challenge on the ground. It is what prevents the officers from writing tickets. If they go to a big party out in Bayshore in Anchorage and there's 30 young people there, those two Anchorage police officers are going to be off the street for hours running those young people's criminal histories, trying to determine where in that schematic they fall to write this ticket. And the real-world effect of it is they walk away without writing any tickets. The second thing is that we don't have any data to suggest that charging the young people with higher and higher crimes actually works. What tends to happen in the real world is if the young person has a real problem with alcohol, it's going to show up in other places in the system. They're either going to be charged with a crime, other crimes besides this status offense of simply possessing or consuming the alcohol because their lives are falling apart because of their relationship with the substance, or they're going to come to the attention of OCS. So there are other places in the system where we see the people, the most young people who are charged with minor consuming or just charged with a first, but those repeat offenders, we often see them having other involvement in other places in the system. And finally, these fines hurt. I mean, they hurt. And if it's $500 and if they don't pay it, it defaults and comes out of their PFD, then that's going to force parental involvement that the current scheme does not force. So we believe that it's worth a try. And it is a different concept, I think, for everyone in the justice system to move away from this idea of continuing escalating penalties. But I think it's important for everyone to keep in mind that this is not a crime. This is an offense that is a young person possessing or consuming a substance that it is legal for them to possess or consume once they reach that magical age. So that status offense, frankly, you know, they could lose their PFD for several years. On my way out of the court system, one of my last days in court, Judge Greg Motika called me up to the bench and said, Ms. Franklin, I think you can fix minor consuming by taking away their first PFD on their first one, two PFDs on their second one, and three PFDs on their third one. And while we didn't write this scheme up that way, it does tend to have that effect. And we think that regardless of the fact that there's not an escalating punishment clause, But the trade-off of that is these tickets are going to be easy to write, and they're going to be able, we're going to be able to consistently apply this penalty, and individuals who have serious problems with alcohol are going to be pushing other pressure points in the system where they're going to show up where they can get more help than through the fact that they have committed this status offense.
Follow up, Senator Stevens.
Just a, thank you. I think you have a good understanding of young people, and I think this is a good plan, and I hope it works well.
So let me just clarify that the last female speaker on the phone was Cynthia Franklin. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, yes.
Thank you. Since we have now more than one person off on the phone, please identify yourself before you respond to the questions. Next question comes from Senator Meyer.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And again, I just want to continue the discussion with the minors in possession. Help me, and maybe this will occur later on. What about the minor attempting to buy, the minor that goes into the brown jug or Chilkoot Charlie's or what have you, and then does this new chapter impact the civil fines that those establishments also use to deter minors from even attempting to buy underage?
This is Cynthia Franklin again, Director of the ABC, through the Chair, Senator Meyer. There was discussion both in the Underage Drinking Subcommittee and in the greater stakeholders group about the civil penalty. We didn't end up changing the civil penalty at this time. We received some feedback from the industry that they consider that to be a useful tool. And if they cannot get a law enforcement officer to respond and ticket a young person for unlawfully being on licensed premises, the ability to charge that young person with that civil penalty offense is a tool that many of our licensees use. It is our hope that as we move forward with some of the changes that are represented in Senate Bill 99, that can be revisited in light of the new penalty. We believe that when it will be an easier ticket for those officers to write, that our licensees will receive more assistance from law enforcement in getting the criminal citations issued and will become less and less reliant on pursuing their own civil penalties. But it is not affected by the draft in front of you.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you for that. Committee members, at this point we're approaching 3 hours of this meeting, and we have approximately 40, am I doing the math correct? Something like 40 more sections, actually more than that, 60 more sections to go. It goes to section 150. Does the committee wish to continue, or would you prefer to adjourn at this time and continue the sectional at our next meeting, which is next Tuesday? How many would like to continue? I'm getting no response, which means everyone would like to adjourn at this time. So with that in mind, then, we will stop here, having completed Section 86 of the bill, unless there are further comments. Mr. Kopp.
Madam Chair, thank you. I think it's a great tactical decision. Just to clarify through the chair to Senator Meyer, it currently, the minor in possession is charged as a violation the first two times, and then the third time when it becomes habitual, it becomes a B misdemeanor. And like Cynthia Franklin said, that just has been ineffective. Additionally, minor consuming now, your second time when it's a repeat minor consuming, your license goes into a revocation status, even if you had nothing to do with being around a vehicle. And they found that also was very problematic. It wasn't effective. And then when it became a B misdemeanor, it would follow the young person indefinitely as an alcohol-related conviction, keeping them out of the military or a host of other job opportunities. So that's all part of the backdrop of this.
Makes sense.
Great. Thank you. I want to thank Mr. Kopp, Ms. Gutierrez, and Ms. Franklin for being with us for this extended meeting today. Our next meeting, well, we will have completed then Section 86. We'll be take this bill up again at Section 87 at our next meeting, Tuesday, April 14th at 1:30. So at this time, we'll adjourn. Let the record reflect. The time is 3:22 p.m. Thank you.